and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And
this hour is brought to you by Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. They're on 3119 Twinview Boulevard in beautiful downtown Shasta Lake.
Metropolitan Shasta Lake.
That's right. That was Metropolitan Shasta Lake. And, yeah, if you're in the market for a new, used Kubota, John Deere, whatever you're looking for, give us a call down there, and they will definitely help you out. Got a great service team. If you've got problems with service issues, give them a call. They can get you in right away. The phone number down there is 226-9226. And they
have the best website in the tractor world, RedingTractors.com.
That's right.
God, who would have thought of such a thing?
I know, I wonder. Team Power.
All righty. We have two guests today. Today we're going to be switching gears, and I'm just going to spoiler alert right now. The second hour is going to go really fast. We're not going to have enough time. And the good news is he's on for 2 hours next week. So we're going to need every bit of that, because I called him last night to see if he'd come on the show with us, and we were on the phone till like, I think it was midnight. So he has a lot of stories. Very interesting man, and it's an amazing topic. Our first hour, we are here with Bruce Moran. And Bruce Moran's a national security advisor, focuses on strategic planning for national security issues. All the good stuff he's doing, he can't tell us about, so I'll just, you know, wreck that for you right there. He is a consultant. He works with public officials, U.S. government committees, departments, agencies, think tanks, corporations. He works on special national security projects and hands-on solutions for crisis preparedness and crisis readiness scenarios. And he's been working a whole lot in North Korea. And that's, I think that's all we get to know. There you go.
Yep.
Well, with that, Bruce, what can you share with us?
A little somber day here, weekend. It's Memorial Day.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up.
My heart goes out to all the families. And this goes back to World War II. We still have some vets from World War II living during their late 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, one of our presidents was a dive bomber. And during World War II, went down. It was Bush Senior,
George W.
Yeah, so he's still going. I remember in his 80s, he was still jumping out of airplanes with a guy helping him, doing parachutes. And
he does.
And it's a different generation, different idea, and about what patriotism was about, and you know how your country is to be served, and God and country, and that. And as we're looking at President Trump, he's actually bringing it back.
You know, I'll tell you what, I listened to his address to the graduates of Annapolis on Friday morning, and it's just nice to have that back, you know, somebody who really cares about our military people.
And recognizes.
Well, it goes back to the Revolution, to the Civil War, we got the Spanish-American War. Excuse me, the War of 1812. I don't want to skip anything. And you know, we have, you know, we're going to talk a little bit today about the Korean War, and what we see today is, you know, ramifications of what happened back in 1952. And to our tremendous vets who served in Korea, thank you. And those who served subsequently in Vietnam, thank you too. That's when they came back from Vietnam. They weren't appreciated, and it took them, I would say, 5 to 6 times longer to readjust to America because everybody looked down on them.
Yeah, they were treated horribly when they came home. And
it's people I knew, you know, too.
Yeah.
It was just,
I'm glad as a country we finally decided that was wrong and didn't continue that really, really bad behavior.
Yeah.
That's why I say it's a somber day for me, because I still work with vets, talk to vets, you know, the American Legion, the VFW post. I mean, people don't know about that too much anymore unless they're, you know, involved with it, and they're far removed from understanding what people did for the country and how they sacrifice their lives. You know, it's our precious blood. And I'm just really beside myself because everybody's too busy to really want to get to know how this country is formed. Our American history has been basically thrown out the door. And that's a shame.
And we've turned things like Memorial Day into, you know, like hot dogs and barbecues. And
barbecue. Let's get out 3-day weekend, you know.
Yeah, go out and get in your boat. Yeah, we forget what it's really all about.
Yeah, my cousin still, we have a place, Abraham Lincoln Memorial. It's like the, I would say, Arlington Cemetery. And he's there quite a bit, you know. And it wears on him, and I talk to him about it. And, you know, I'm a sounding board, he's mine. And, you know, he puts the bodies into the ground all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And that whole thing about how you respect and what you do and how the families are. The families carry this their whole lives.
Of course.
People don't realize that. I mean,
it's permanent loss.
23 vets a day that are still committing suicide because of post-traumatic stress from Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, that's a huge toll taken on families to see your loved one take their own life. And it just breaks my heart.
I would, I guess I would be happy to see people actually realize that you put your hand over your heart when the flag is brought into the room. I go to so many things where people don't even know that you put your hand over your heart when the national anthem is played.
Or take off your hat.
Or take off your hat.
Take off your hat.
Take off your hat. Yeah, some of these things, I mean, it's just, it's a respect and honor thing. And, you know, we got all tangled up in the kneeling in the football games. And I thought, well, good, maybe somebody's going to learn what you actually are supposed to do. But we didn't really get that far. We just got tangled in the kneeling.
That's right.
Lovely.
The owners just in the last 2 weeks have come out and said you can't kneel.
Right. Got to hide in the locker room if you're a traitor.
When they're playing the national anthem.
All traitors shall hide in the locker room.
That's true. I mean, of course you get a choice. I think we had this conversation before. And I was saying if the players get to protest, then why not the referees? Why not the cheerleaders? And, you know, everybody has an issue.
Sure.
How about the guys in the stands and the gals in the stands and the
Well, at the end of the day, it's their job.
I mean, you might have an hour before the game for everybody to protest and then let the game go on thereafter.
Yeah, right. Ollie and free. Protest time's over.
I was listening to one of the talk shows last week, and they were, I forget who I was listening to, but they said, you know, when you go to work and you know, you have a regular job and your boss says, hey, these are the rules that we operate under, and if you break those rules, there'll be consequences.
And you
abide by those rules in the workplace. Why is it any different with the NFL? I mean, their bosses say this is what you can and can't do, and if you do it, there's consequences.
It took them a while, but I think they finally realized that they were their employers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think their actual attendance, they said, went down like 80% or something.
Belt them in the wallet.
Yeah, it was big, and so they decided maybe we better start doing the right thing.
Well, I would encourage people to look around in your local community if you're listening to this on the 27th of May, 2018, because we do replay shows, so if you're listening to this and it's not Memorial Day, we're not time traveling. It really happened on Memorial Weekend. There will be lots of events in your communities on Monday. And then there are always events commemorating actual Memorial Day, which is the 30th. And I know here in Reading, they have a big thing at the Civic out on the lawn every year at 11 o'clock, 11 a.m. on Wednesday, the 30th. So take a look at your local community. If you have kids, it'd be a great way to teach them what Memorial Day is really all about. And then you can get back to, you know, the barbecue. Because then it makes sense. You know, you've done it all as a big picture. All right, we've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Bruce Moran. You're listening to We the People, and you can join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Gone as far as tearing Wallace stickers off the bumpers of cars, and he voted for George McGovern for president. Well, he's a friend of them long-haired hippie-type pick-o fags. I bet you he's even got a commie flag tacked up on the wall inside of his garage. He's a snake in the grass, I tell you guys. He may look dumb, but that's just a disguise. He's a mastermind in the ways of espionage.
What the heck goes through your mind when you pick this music? Holy mackerel.
I don't know. It was kind of hearkening back to a little Vietnam era fun, you know? Easy Rider.
Yeah, I talked to a Marine from Vietnam just this weekend. He said, yeah, we should have won that war. We didn't want to. You know, there were protests going on, and, you know,
there's no
everybody
doubt.
He has a different opinion about Vietnam. You know, it would be a discussion we can have for 2 hours.
Oh, sure.
But I want to get to what the topic of today is, and that's North Korea.
All right,
speaking of wars, we should have won.
You know, but yeah. For history purposes, we know that Korea is divided up into the North and South. And it's divided on the 38th parallel. How did that happen? Well, towards the end of the war in North Korea, when we went in there, General MacArthur was our leader and well-respected, you know, at that time. And we decided after Japan that we weren't going to use a nuclear weapon anymore. And at that time, it was called the atomic bomb. So, you know, I guess they went back and forth to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and then the President and, you know, how you make that decision. But it was decided not to use it. And this was up north when they were at the Chosin Reservoir. So it's called the Battle of Chosin or the Battle of Chosin Reservoir. And I don't think people realize that we're considered U.N. troops, but we constituted, the U.S. Army and Marines constituted about, I'd say 95% of the troops in North Korea at that time. And if you look at who we were fighting, you were thinking, oh, we're fighting the North Koreans. No, we were fighting the Chinese
yeah.
under Mao Zedong. So that's a whole different idea, you know, about what was going on up there. You know, and Mao had a Chinese general he assigned a battle to. His name is Sun Xiulun. And basically they used a tactic from Sun Tzu's book, The Art of War. And they attacked us during a very hard time to move. When would that be? What would you think?
Winter time.
You better believe it. And they used a tactic called surround the enemy. But they also know the countryside, right? So if you do a lot of heavy research, I break it out into four or five simple things, but I can go into 20 or 30 things they were doing. But if we look at what they did is called surround the enemy, and you surround them, but how are they surrounding them? How are they surrounding our posts and our bases in the Chosin Reservoir area? They would attack by night in swarms, in companies. And they also would move at night. And they move vast amounts of people at night. If you know the terrain, what do you have?
Well, they had mountains, and I think they had the high ground in most cases, didn't they?
Well, they knew where to go. They knew mm-hmm. how to move at night.
Right.
So they went around in between you, and that's how they got to test you out. You know what yin and yang are? It's like pressure points.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, they go yin and yang on you. They test your strength, check your weakness, check your strength. This is all going on at the same time. This was a huge 17-day battle at night. So they swarm at night. And then they move at night. They swarm at night, they move at night. They swarm at night, they move at night. And we're talking about swarms of people. You know, they have companies. And they would come in and just, they can swarm in, but they wouldn't have to attack you. They come around you. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then they go in between, and then they surround maybe a post. And you'd be trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and our guys were pretty much cut off on that battle. I mean, they had no reinforcements and basically had to fight their way out of there.
That's right.
They just got in too deep and got in without any support.
We had intel coming in that there was something coming, but we didn't know how, when, and the Chinese knew how to use it. See what I mean? the Art of War talks about, the first thing you read about the Art of War is what? The number one thing.
Know your enemy.
So you can't tell your enemy what you're doing.
Right.
You do it, and you do it at so many different levels. Now, when I'm talking about the reservoir, you go around the reservoir and do all these things in maybe 20 or 30 spots. You take out the post, and you might take out a base or hit a base and go to another base, take out another post. You see what I mean? It's done so you keep the enemy guessing at all times. And when you outnumber people, you know, like at this, 20, 30 to 1, you know, how many troops they were using at that time on the Chinese side, how many companies. A company constitutes about, well, anywhere between 100, 150 people. Studies have been done, you know. I mean, these are studies that show all around the world that all troops work more efficiently together in groups of 100 to 150. I find that fascinating. When you put anybody together in that kind of a group, they will operate at higher optimum levels. And what would you think one of the first of these things of troop embodiment first came about? Do you recall this at all?
Uh-uh. No, I don't know anything about that.
The Romans.
Of course.
Remember the Romans, big 10x10 groups? They had those big shields and spears.
Yeah.
And then they had the short. They also had that short, once they get in close encounters, they had a short sword, then they strike with that. But they had these long shields, and they call them turtles, and they move in. And then they form arcs over their head and in front to protect them from the arrows coming in. And there would be groups of 100 men, 10x10. Yeah. I find that fascinating. And that strategy carries forward up until today. You know? Mm-hmm. And we're doing asymmetrical guerrilla warfare. You'll see SEAL teams coming in, but they have something like that, but it's in smaller groups. But you can have a whole command go out, but usually it's groups of, I would say, 9 to 15, or depending on what you need in the field. But
well, that's kind of where the
SOG groups are, you know, similarly trained in the guerrilla warfare tactics.
Isn't that where the British box came in as well? They formed that square of layers of men.
That's right, exactly. And that was fought with Wellington and, you know, Napoleon. Wellington took the high ground. He had superior troops, but he had to retreat, you know. So Wellington knew how to, you know, out-strategize Napoleon in that last battle there before he went to Elba. So these are, you know, and so if you look at this tactics around the enemy, I'll give you another example. There's an African group of warriors. Who were the most feared groups of warriors in Africa? Do you remember this?
The Zulus.
Mm-hmm.
The Zulus, yeah. And what the Zulus would do, and some of this is in Sun Tzu's Art of War, if you, you know, want to, you know, correlate it, and the Zulus would send out the first wave of people, and they would test your firepower. I'm talking about when they fought the British. So they lose so many warriors. You just send them out there to attack them. So they're figuring out where they're firing from and how fast they reload. The second group will come out and figure out where the weaknesses were in that firing and reloading. The third group would attack you. Yeah.
God.
They didn't worry about losing warriors. They're just figuring out how to attack you.
Yeah,
so
that was
the mentality of collateral damage, you know, people losing lives has changed completely over the years, you know, and the rules of engagement have changed. So, you know, I talked to Aaron momentarily yesterday, and we're talking about, you know, the World War II, the amount of lives that were lost in battles, you know, bodies upon bodies on the ground, you know, going into D-Day, you know, Normandy, and, you know, different, you know, the Battle of the Bulge, when one of our family members was there, and, you know, that was terrible. You know, he survived. You know, he's one of the 101st Airborne members that survived, so. And it was just brutal. I mean, brutal and cruel and mean. And to survive, you know, we had to do the best we can over there. I don't know if you remember at the Battle of the Bulge, we were trapped and we didn't. Our 101st got decimated and they were in the forest and fighting. So it was really something.
Well, that was also during the winter time as well.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. So if we get back to the 38th parallel, the reservoir areas where they had that last big battle, and the Chinese just swarmed down, you can say that, and then we retreated, and that's when they came to a peaceful resolution, or they were still at war, because that's what they're doing today. That's where you see President Kim and President Moon from South Korea talking about having a one, you know, Korea model. So,
but didn't
they're looking at peace between the two Koreas?
But didn't MacArthur? He wanted to finish that. He wanted to go all the way to China with that. And I think, you know, when you talk about wars we should have won, I think Korea was a classic example of a war we should have won handily. But it became this political battle rather than a military battle.
We even used all our tools in our
right
shed. I mean, if we dropped an atomic bomb, you know, and like we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there would have been a lot of loss, you know, but that would have stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time, so that was, what, seven years after World War II, we probably had in our arsenal thousands, you know, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 of those kind of bombs.
Mm-hmm.
So we chose not to.
Well, just coming off of World War II, I think people
were devastated.
Yeah, they were. They didn't have the stomach to have these massive casualty counts.
Nagasaki, I've been there. You know, I went to Hiroshima and I looked at. You know, they still have all the flowers there. The Japanese are beside themselves. But
mm-hmm.
As we get back to North Korea, then we're looking at what actually happened, and if you look at 52 and now it's 2018, the Korean people are probably looking to get back together. But how are they going to do it? Well, as you look at Secretary Pompeo, he's offering them economic incentives to boost their economy. He called it boom the economy. Well, if you're in a economy like the North Koreans, and they're pretty much in the, you know, I would say underbelly of understanding the world markets, and their practices and standards aren't up to world, you know, standards and practices, then you have to come on board and see what you can do. What they will do in, is show them how to get their economy going. Anything you do there will be a boom to them.
Well, yeah, you could send somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, I mean, and could probably make their economy better. Those poor guys.
Yeah, the best example is South Korea is huge, you know, mm-hmm. industrial complex, and they're doing extremely well. So
yeah, you would think just jealousy, they'd want to hang out with them a little bit more.
Well, we got to take a break, but when we come back, let's talk about how you take a regime like they have in North Korea.
That's
into
right.
the 21st century, because, I mean, to give them aid that will actually go towards building their economy versus giving them aid that's just going to fatten the wallet of the regime, I'm not sure how you do that. Let's talk about that when we come
right.
back.
All righty. We'll be right back with our guest, Bruce Moran.
A man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. He takes odds are he won't live. You see tomorrow. Secret agent man, secret.
Going off to the spirit in the sky. It's where I'm gonna go when I die. When I die and the name is at rest, I'm gonna go to the place that's the best.
Hey, we're back.
Could listen to that song all day.
Yeah. I got one for you. What's President Kim's, one of his favorite songs?
Oh. I don't know.
Rocky.
Really?
Yeah.
Looks the Rocky theme song? Because I immediately thought of Rocket Man, but then that's President Trump's favorite song for
Kim Jong-un.
And we're playing that down right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's important that we understand that he's a man too, you know, and he has a family and kids and stuff like that. You know, he's a leader of a country.
And a crazy person, but
well,
that notwithstanding,
he's young. He's around 36 years old. So
okay,
to be a leader of a country like that, and that's huge.
So
his temperament is geared towards deferring to his generals and, I would say, to President Xi from China. When he's, you know, learning how to, you know, really get into negotiations with the United States and, you know, have his ally, President Xi from China, you know, help him, you know, get to where they want to go.
Well, see, that's
he did offer. Now, let me explain this. He did offer, you know, a peace solution. He let three prisoners go. Never done before. The North Koreans let three prisoners go, and President Trump, Vice President Pence, and Melania were all at Andrews Air Force Base when they came back. So that was a really nice gesture, you know, to start out. Then last Saturday, he had bombed his nuclear sites in the manufacturing of where you have your nuclear.
But wasn't that
the problem with that is I think he did, but there was no way to, you know, have a strict verification. But no matter what happened, it was a good gesture on his part. I don't think the media was covering these and keeping them in a logical. He is offering through his way, the best way he knows how, to extend the olive branch to have a summit talk with President Trump.
No, I agree. I think he realizes his best move is going to be come to some sort of negotiation with the United States to pull his country out of the dark ages. But I guess my biggest question is, how do you trust somebody that who, you know, their country just has this history of making promises that they never fulfill, and their regime is so, you know, humanitarian wise that they just kill millions of their own people. How does that change?
Yeah, how do we do something that helps those people?
Exactly. How do you know if we're going to give them economic relief? How do we do that and guarantee that it's actually going to go towards making their country, you know, a freer place and not just one big death camp?
That's the way the... So you have to have a department in the U.S. government assigned to do that. And what department would that be?
I was going to say we're not short on government departments, so...
No, that would be the State Department.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe we had one specifically just for that. You know, the Lucy and the football department, you know, they work on those special cases.
You need a prime mover, then you have the other agencies work with the prime mover.
Mm-hmm.
So you need Commerce, right?
Right.
Okay, that's, you know, Ross. Secretary Ross, and you need Treasury, you know, and you need, you know, different people to kind of help move that along. But you need a prime mover. That would be Secretary Mike Pompeo. Mike has the wherewithal, you know, to do a lot of these things. Do you recall that he was at West Point at all? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's been
doing it. Oh, he's a great guy. I think he would do a fantastic job. It's just whether or not North Korea is going to give us the access to go in and do it.
And assign different parts of the State Department. We had this discussion before. You know how many people work in the State Department?
No.
Zillion.
Did you remember? Okay. It's close to 70,000 people.
Actually, it's not. I mean, 360,000 MBA, 30,000 in the Forest Service.
There's not MBA.
70,000?
That's the problem. That's what Bill is talking about. Do they know how to go in? Diplomats.
Mm-hmm.
Start a program up and making sure, and this is what Bill is saying, oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called regional stewardship. And you'd work closely, you know, with Korea, of course, but all the countries in the region. What do you have? Russia there, China, Malaysia, the Philippines, you know, Vietnam. You start trading with them and you watch the markets expand. But what you're talking about, what do you do to make sure that's not being put just into the military budget the monies that are coming through the economic programs.
Which has happened
in
the past.
That's called top-down.
Right.
Okay. So instead of being top-down, you have to go in there for being what? Bottom-up. So they have to integrate it. And that's called NGOs, universities, and the very small businesses and intermediate businesses. You create industrial parks, and you go in there and watch the parks grow. And you monitor it, and you help them educate the people in those areas. So you'll have a diverse group of people that will be starting different kinds of small businesses, intermediate businesses, and creating the industrial park. That's what gives you your diversity. That's what you're talking about. It won't be just one group of people doing one thing. You know, it's not a unilateral military hierarchical thing. If you get a bunch of entrepreneurs coming together and forming all these businesses and starting an industrial park.
I understand what you're saying, but what I'm having trouble believing is that when you have somebody like Un at the top who has a history of such bizarre humanitarian tactics, how does he change that to give his people more freedom and without his fear of losing control of his country? Because, I mean, he's the iron fist.
That's how it works, though. He gives that latitude to that industrial park.
He has to.
In terms of watching it grow, seeing how it benefits people and how it'll make him much more of a powerful leader as his economy booms and then he has tax revenue coming in.
Right.
I mean, there's a benefit of having businesses grow, you know, and having your economy grow from a, I would call it an underground economy and a extra legal economy to a formal economy, or going from an informal economy to a formal economy. And that's a huge change for the people, because that gives them the wherewithal to keep the industrial park itself lively and economically sound. So each time you create an industrial park, you're creating another vibrant part of the economy where other people in North Korea say, "I want that.
Right, right.
I want to do that."
And I hope he looks at South Korea as a model and not China, because I think China is his mentor, and
That's one of the questions that can be asked. I think that's a great question. How does South Korea and China share their technology?
Right.
How will they get along? And will North Korea grow at a vast amount where it surpasses, you know, the South Koreans?
Right.
I mean, that's a consideration, right? Who's our ally?
Yeah.
South Korea.
Absolutely.
That's one of the considerations that we think of. You know, how do you look at the national security of South Korea as you start introducing the economic boom to North Korea?
Right, and I think that's going to be a fear on China's part to lose control of their little puppet over there and, you know, basically give way to South Korea and the Western, democratic process. Do you think China will be...
I think China will just be hands off and let it go.
Oh, well, that'd be great. Yeah, I.
No, no, China doesn't want to have a war there, because where do all the refugees go?
Right.
Right into China. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the Koreans will be rushing headlong into China. They got to take care of all those people.
That's right.
That is a neighborly consideration.
Yeah, but one of the things too you got to look at: North Korea has all the natural resources that China would like to have. You
know? Oh, I didn't know that.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so that's also in the, I would consider that the eastern part of China, too.
What natural resources does the north have?
You know, the mining, stuff like that.
Oh, minerals. Okay.
Nothing you can eat.
But that's also, it's looking at the east, now they have the same thing in the west.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened in the west, they assumed that territory in the west. What's that called?
Come on, History Channel guy. Call in a lifeline.
I thought that was China.
Well, yeah, it's Tibet, but it's also China.
Oh, okay.
Tibet.
Yeah. So they went in there, and that's such a huge, vast area with such a great amount of natural resources mm-hmm. that they just took it over. So where did Dalai Lama go?
Tibet?
No, I think he's hanging out.
No. He went to North India.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
He escaped.
He's kind of all over the place,
actually. When the Chinese army came in?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, well, I got one for you. Uh-oh. Where were his bodyguards trained?
Who's the
bodyguards?
The Dalai Lama.
The Dalai Lama?
Yeah.
Taiwan.
Okay, that's a shot.
That took a shot.
Well, that's where they made their clothes. Come on,
okay,
come
I'll
on.
Give you a hint, okay?
Okay.
Aspen area?
Oh. Colorado?
Yep. Colorado, yeah.
Unless there's another Aspen out there somewhere.
Who trained them there?
Friends of yours?
Probably the Special Forces or...
Steven Seagal?
Seagal is there.
Steven Seagal.
Who is Steven Seagal for 100?
He's in Russia right now, so I don't think we should mention his name, you know, but... one of the things that... it was the...
I did that for the sheriff.
During World War... two, this is historical fact, we had the OSS. And after World War II, we had what?
MI6?
No, that's the British.
That's the British.
CIA?
And they've got MI1, MI2.
Yeah, so that's who trained the...
the CIA.
Dalai Lama's, I would call them bodyguards in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's confusing.
Yeah,
they took them into the terrain and, you know...
Obviously, that was secret because we don't know anything about it. Either that or we might be knuckleheads.
Well, they sure as heck didn't tell me about it. I'll tell you that or I would have remembered.
So that, okay, what was not during World War II?
I love this game. This is super fun.
Did you know that we didn't have an Air Force?
That's correct.
During World War II? It was Army Corps. The Air Force came after World War II, the U.S. Air Force. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, no, I did not know that. I thought we had the Air Force during World War II. Well, yeah. World War One, we didn't have an Air Force.
No. I mean, we had an Air Force, but it's part of the Army Corps.
But it was the Army Air Corps.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The Air Force didn't separate itself till after World War Two. So we have two things happening at that time.
Okay,
we're going to...
clandestine services of the OSS, and that became the CIA, and then you had the Air Force.
I think
that's pretty good history, you know,
that is
for
history.
People to understand that now we have all these different branches in the military, Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, that's how they're looking at what happened and why Kim changed his mind. So,
he looked at that and said, probably going to not win, so.
What did he see, though? I mean, just recently, in the last year from President Trump, what did he see? President Trump, and this
willingness
is
to come and whoop him.
If you're firm and resolute in your decision making,
mm-hmm.
you act.
Yep.
You have to act. That's what Sun Tzu says. You have to act. President Trump acts. What he says he does, he does.
Right.
So where did he act? And what was why did Kim understand that? He's going to act against him in North Korea.
All right, we're going to have to call a lifeline during the break. Saved by the break. So great. So good. So good to have a break.
And then you'll have my final answer.
Final answer. We'll come up to the break. You're listening to We the People. We're going to be back in 2 minutes. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Thank you.
See, now you can go with John Cougar Mellencamp for your theme when you're negotiating,
or you can go with James Taylor and You Got a Friend, but that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, we decided that the answer wasn't
James.
Take the girl bike riding John Kerry with James Taylor to negotiate.
Yeah, that.
Anything other than that spells world business.
Also Iran and give him, $500 billion and say,
yeah.
Yeah. We're going to give you a whole.
Nuclear weapons and.
Yeah, if you promise.
A year and a half later, we're going,
Well, you promised to do it. We'll give you all your money back. Yeah, no, that's not how we play.
Yeah, Mike Pompeo was there talking about that on the air, too. And he was talking about Iran. This is also this weekend. It's a very serious situation because we let our back door down, and Iran just squirms right through it. So,
yep.
Thank you.
yep. And I think
that door is
closing hard right now on
I'm
Iran.
I'm not using the back door as another example for our cybersecurity. In the end of 2016, all our CIA tools were given up. That was the back doors to computers,
mm-hmm.
how they use their offensive techniques. Nobody did anything about that. So we had these vulnerabilities that existed, and now President Trump is being resolute and firm, like I'm getting back to our conversation in Sun Tzu Art of War, and he's taking it to the table.
Right.
I'm talking about the negotiation table, and hopefully the summit is on June 12th.
Right.
And your concern was, how is he understanding that he has to come to the table? And my point was, President Trump is firm and resolute because he drew the line in Syria. He saw that, and he struck twice.
Mm-hmm.
Second time, there were, I believe, 110 bombs coming in, and they were perfectly executed at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Plus, he got
thinking to himself.
Plus, he got our allies to go in with him. I mean, it wasn't just a
from four different spots.
Exactly.
And he's thinking, "Oh my God, what am I going to do to defend against that if I screw up at some point?"
Right.
But there was something else that was very important too. That was demonstrated.
Well, I think that was his willingness to pull out.
There was another incident that happened where we used something.
Hey, Steven Seagal?
No,
okay.
No, it was in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
We used the mother of all bombs there.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
That's a bomb.
I forgot about that.
You know where he has all his nuclear stuff? In the mountains in North Korea there? You drop one of those there and...
Goodbye.
Hasta la vista, the Terminator comes out, and you take care of that. I mean, you drop three or four of them, but, and for the amount of area they cover, but it'll make a different impression on the people that aren't left there.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
You don't have nothing to say, and that's a pretty big statement, that you wipe out everything, and they're gone.
Yeah, and there's no, we don't have any ground troops to worry about. I mean, that would really...
You just take care of all those...
Yeah.
Places that he has his nuclear sites and missiles. It's just not nuclear, but it's missiles that are pointing at North Korea. If North Korea decides to attack, we know we're going to lose Seoul.
Oh, yeah, South Korea is gone.
There's a second city, in central Korea that everybody flees to. But can you imagine that we lose half the people in Seoul? Or maybe 70%, depending on the kind of attack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they said maybe a million people would die if he unleashed the...
Easy.
Yeah, it's just his artillery that he has on the DMZ into South Korea. It would.
Yeah.
But we can't stop that.
No. But he knows once that's a commitment, he's done. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. In the end.
There's a few Mohabs there. We got our THAAD missiles. We got our submarines. We got our battleships. That's what he was a little worried about recently. He was saber-rattling because we were doing our maneuvers there. And you send over our bombers, and it's like I said, hasta la vista,
sure.
And everything goes.
Yeah, sure. Short
whatever
game.
He had there would be vanquished.
Yeah, he'd have a first strike capability that would be pretty devastating.
It would be
but
called
the
a
long
last
game,
strike.
Yeah, the long game is he's no longer around, and I think he realizes that.
I think that's what I was drawing the same conclusion by giving these examples.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he can survive. I'm not saying he can't survive, but he might end up in China.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. As that country, if let's say they do make a deal and they do start to develop and become more.
Well, they'll have elections. Remember?
Right. Right. And they're not going to want
together
him.
And they have elections.
Yeah.
And that'll change the whole dynamics.
So I think that's what he's afraid of.
Well, it'll take a while to deprogram everybody.
No, we don't know. What was that best example? What we saw that most recently, where two separating countries, communist and west, came together.
Recently?
Okay, last 25 years.
Okay, I was like...
I'm thinking historically.
I'm like, recently?
Last week.
Last week, I'm thinking...
Southern California, where those sanctuary cities were tossed out. No,
yeah. I was going to say, what is the Mexican border by San Diego?
No, I'm talking about historically, where we saw a communist side and
sure.
a western side come together.
Ukraine, maybe?
Ukraine, I don't think that was, it's a little more sophisticated in Ukraine. Now you have to talk about that for a whole hour. Mm-hmm. Crimea and Khrushchev in 52 and mm-hmm. how that all evolved into Sevastopol, the military base, and they had agreements all the way to 2042 with Russia, and they had their own parliament in Crimea. I don't know if people know this stuff. They had their own president there, but they decided not to have a president. I think it was in about 7 or 8 years ago, but they still had their own parliament in Crimea. So mm-hmm. there's a whole geopolitical, strategical idea about Ukraine. I mean, it's fertile agricultural base there. It's just unbelievable. It would be like California was probably 40 years ago.
Still a little bit radioactive up in the north end there, but other than that, it's pretty nice country.
But I'm talking about Ukraine in where they have all their farming.
All
region.
The farms, sure.
Yeah.
And that's because the topsoil, that's what I'm talking about. The California topsoil isn't the same today as it was 50 years ago.
No.
They have all that there. So that's like a really rich area to provide agricultural base for a lot of different reasons. So that's a geopolitical decision that's made. So, I mean, that's a whole different thing. But we're talking about now Germany. Germany is probably the best example where East came together
sure.
with West.
Berlin Wall.
There was under President Reagan when he met with Gorbachev and they tore down the wall in 91.
Well, I think that's going to be what I think the folks in the world are going to be looking for is another Berlin Wall incident in North Korea. And I think it's possible. God, I wish we had another hour. We could talk about that whole thing.
How much time do we have?
A minute.
About a minute left.
About a minute? Okay, I want to thank all the veterans' families. God bless you. Thank you, Chief of Staff Kelly. You lost one of your sons. Thank you, General Mattis.
We love General Mattis. And you know what? If I was Kim Jong-un, I'd be thinking about General Mattis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's great.
You wouldn't want the mad dog coming after you. That's a deterrent.
I'm breaking up here, personally, you know.
I know. I heard you. I was trying to have some happy chatter in the background.
Yeah. I'm just...
I know.
It gets my heart going because it's terrible.
It is, and it's a... it's a good thing we keep Memorial Day. I don't think they're trying to get rid of it for some unknown reason. I think we get to keep it as Memorial Day. So
that's right.
Thank you.
They didn't merge it with another.
they didn't turn it into some kind of solstice or some weirdo thing. So thank you to all of our military veterans.
Absolutely, thank you.
And their families and those who have sacrificed
all
of it. Thank
all the veterans, their families. It goes all the way back to World War II. You're brave. You're wonderful Americans, and God bless you all.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks a lot, Bruce.
And we'll be talking again real soon.
We will chat with you very soon.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to come back with Dr. Harry Booyans. We're going to shift gears and talk about South Africa. You're not going to want to miss it. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and you're listening to the second hour of We the People Radio. You can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Team Power, a John Deere Kubota dealer in Shasta Lake, California. Everything John Deere and Kubota, you can get it there. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard, and you can reach them at 226-9226. Get a great deal on a tractor, get service work, and find them on the web at readingtractors.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
Look at that. Not even a blunder.
No.
We were quick, in and out, because this hour, chock full of information. We're going to run out of time. So our guest is Dr. Harry Booyans. He's an internationally recognized, multiple award-winning, say that three times fast, PhD defense and aerospace physicist. Obviously knows lots of things we don't know anything about. He is originally from South Africa with a 360-year bloodline in that country. He lives with his family on the forested slopes outside Vancouver, Canada, and his life as a scientist exposed him to many of the realities of the Cold War in the period immediately following the fall of the Berlin Wall that we were just discussing in the previous hour, oddly enough. It included interaction with the United States and the British defense establishment. He applies his lifetime of research and interpretive skills to history and genealogy and writes with factual accuracy and engaging style on these subjects. Hard evidence is a trademark of his work, and it's won him a number of awards. He focuses on making Americans aware of what is happening in South Africa, the historic parallels between our two countries of the United States and South Africa, and the warning that South Africa holds for Western civilization in general, and the United States in particular. I really, really hope that you share this with other people, because I guarantee you, you know nothing about what's going on in South Africa.
Nope, you're not hearing anything on the mainstream media about it.
This will be very much like the shows we did some years back on Libya. And people really loved them. We found some people who really knew what was going on the ground and came and told us about that. We've also posted all sorts of great stuff that Dr. Booyans has sent us. And one of the – I have not been able to read it yet, but the Great Obama Reversal, it's his view over the Obama years. Very interesting, what little we discussed last night in our three-hour – hi, could you come on the radio chat, our quick little chat? I think you'll find it fascinating. So, without further ado, how's your afternoon going?
Oh, hi, Aaron.
I thought I'd get through all that exhausting stuff.
Thank you very much for that. It's nice to be on your show.
Well, thank you for coming on.
This is
one of those
things that you really have to have somebody who, you know, who knows and can demystify it. And actually, I'm going to say 99% of the people listening to this have been lied to for years about what's going on in South Africa.
Well,
that's my call.
Usually when I hear the word South Africa and lie in the same sentence, it's a cue for me to say something. Did I get that right?
Yeah,
I just, you know, it's interesting because it's amazing that this all could be really packaged differently, sold differently. But you have a really cool perspective, and so however you would like to get us into this, we'll just follow along.
Well, let me. Maybe I should introduce this at the point where I actually got into this. Yes, I was born in South Africa. Yes, I grew up there, left there at the age of 47, settled in Canada, and been working at companies like Kodak and so forth in Canada. And so one day in 2006, it was quite clear to me that our son would have to get a cochlear implant, because he was born hard of hearing, and made that decision over here to go ahead with this lot. And so I joined a forum on a website it was an American website, and to learn more about how all of this works. And these folks were discussing absolutely anything and everything. And one day when I heard for the manyth time about farm murders in South Africa, I said on that forum that things are out of hand down there, and sometime or other decent people are going to have to react. And so folks asked me about that, and I started explaining. And then a person from the Netherlands posted a little line that said, "Yes, Harry, but you should tell them what happened before," implying that there is some sort of justification for farmers being tortured to death just because they're white. And to the everlasting credit of the Americans on the website, they reacted pretty much as one human being and said nothing justifies this. And, you know, I thanked them for that and said, well, you know, thank you terribly much for that, but maybe our Dutch friend is correct and I should start and tell you what went before. But can I please start at the beginning?
Sure.
Oh, sure.
And they said yes, and my comment was, well, that's going to take a while because I would have to start the story in about 1652. And I would have to explain what went before, since Holland was involved in that, as pointed out by my Dutch friend. So I wrote what in the end became an 80-page treatise, screed, doorstop, whatever. I wrote this thing in parts, and I posted a section sort of once a night or once every 3 nights. And after a while, folks got hold of me from this website and said, but Harry, where's the book that you're getting all the stuff from? And I told them, no, there's no book. It's just the history as I learned it. And as a science guy, I tend to look for evidence. So I just dug up the stuff as I went through my life. And they said, well, if there's no book, pal, you had better make a plan. Okay, so the impetus for my involvement on the subject and my writing of this book that is torturing my life, it's called Amabulu, all of that actually came from the United States because decent people there got outraged. And so some of them eventually put this together as one entire document. So eventually I hung this 80-page PDF document on the internet, and then people really started reading it. And so I was approached to, you know, can I please turn this into a book so people can read it properly and so forth? And so I said, look, guys, I'm a scientist. I got a day job. I really don't want to be writing books. That's not who I am. That's not what I'm about. And though book writing runs in the family, I didn't particularly want to do that. You know, I write patents for a living. I got work to do and a family to feed. But people didn't let up. So when one more time a idiot here in Canada mouthed off about how it is justified that farmers should be murdered in South Africa, I could take it not one inch further. And that was the day that I went down to my family, told them, I am now going to start writing. And I wrote the sort of intro phrases of the book, walked downstairs again, put it in front of my wife, who, you know, naturally is my worst critic on earth.
Amen, brother.
You know what I'm talking about. So I gave it to the worst possible critic on earth. She took a look at this and looked at me with huge, big saucer-shaped eyes, and she said, did you write this? You know, so obviously my dearly beloved was in total shock that I'd put together something that actually sounded almost like it could be read. And that's where it started. And it was at that point, this stuff had been hanging around for a year, and I'd started writing that day. And that day was around this time in 2007. It took me until November 2013 to finish this thing. So all in all, a slice of my life equal to 7 years. I, in fact, went to 7 countries over that period to get information, and I dug through archives and things, because the history of country A is often found in the archives of country B. In this case, the information was spread over places like New York in the United States, and Copenhagen in Denmark, and The Hague in Holland, and odd, peculiar little villages along the Rhine in Germany, tiny little villages in France, some information from Indonesia, and of course some from the Cape of Good Hope. And then there's the British archives, where I physically went and sat down and went through all this stuff. So in the end, what happened was this book, and it was precipitated by Americans getting outraged about what is happening in South Africa. But lo and behold, not a peep out of the regular media. Nothing.
Big shock. Nothing. They were really busy with other things, really important things, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure they were preparing to nail President Trump. They just didn't know it yet.
they just didn't know. They were waiting for Russia, Russia, Russia. We have to take a really quick break, and we will come back with our guest, Dr. Harry Booyens. His book is spelled, just for those of you that maybe are not online, it's AMABHULU. And the subtitle is The Birth and Death of the Second America. And his last name is, I guess I should spell that too, as long as we're doing spelling. His last name is spelled Booyens, so that you can search that or find the book. I have links on our site to the Amazon and all that and the online book for you. You can get that at wethepeopleradio.us along with his blog and all that good stuff. We will be right back in 2 seconds.
Who's to say? I can't do everything, but I can try. And as I roll along, I begin to find things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I've
made all my friends. We're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing, and there's no way we ever could. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. Just feel like we don't have the means to rise above and beat it. So we keep waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change. We keep on waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change.
We're trying to help the world change a little bit, getting some information out there. Okay. Back to the story.
I was thinking, Aaron, that since I heard one of your intro commercials there had something to do with John Deere, I should point out that when you look at the farmers in South Africa and the central wheat and corn growing part of the country, kind of the same guys as what you see in the States, and you know, they drive the same John Deere's. They speak English with a slightly different accent, but they're in church every Sunday morning and once a month at communion. You know, it's the same guys. If you go and speak to them, you're going to hear it's the same issues. They're worried about whether they're going to have the money for the seed for next year. They're going to worry about whether there's going to be enough rain. There's going to be a prayer day for rain. I don't think it's that much different from the U.S.
No.
And so you might well ask, why do I focus so intently on the United States? And I actually published a little article on that, and it raises a couple of points in that area. And the one is that the U.S. is the only country in the world of 2018 that can and might cause the ANC government of South Africa enough political and economic pain to change its direction and to stop its low-level genocide campaign against white people based on their skin color. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, right now the U.S. has a president in Mr. Donald Trump with the guts to do the right thing, and his rather fractious Congress is not in control of foreign policy. He is. Okay, I know that Congress overruled Reagan. Everybody says Reagan, these days they say he was a saint. Somebody needs to explain to me why Congress overruled him in 1986 when it insisted on applying sanctions against South Africa. And he said, please don't. You don't know what's going on. Don't do that. And they ignored him. I also wrote that I believe that our joint bloodline, extraordinarily similar histories, the respective dealings with the British, similar experience with the Dutch, the cultural histories as frontier nations on the outer edges of Western civilization, the Afrikaner is the post office issue American's closest cousin, down to the guns, Bibles, and John Deere tractors and cut the crap attitude, including praise the Lord and pass the ammo.
South Africa, we were kind of chuckling on the phone last night. They're the embodiment of our flyover states.
Yeah. I agree. I guess that the as I say, the post office issue Afrikaner would see himself as a occupant of the flyover states of the U.S. And my last point is, I just simply fundamentally trust the basic value system of the ordinary American. I know Churchill kind of said that one can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. But it suggests that if I hang in there long enough, they'll eventually settle on doing the proper, decent, humane thing. Okay? I put it on paper. They are just fundamentally more humane than any other powerful nation out there, no matter what the Europeans try to tell you, and fundamentally they have the appropriate combination of heart and guts. Now, don't let it go to your heads totally, but that's how I feel about the United States.
We have the potential, how's that, if we live up to it?
Okay, so that's, you know, I have been asked why my total focus on the U.S., and that's it. The matters happening in South Africa are getting attention in the Belgian parliament. I can just see, you know, hordes of C-130s with Belgian paratroopers heading for South Africa, right?
Not.
Yeah, earth-shaking.
Yeah, and our old ancestors, the Dutch, you know, when they can finally rest themselves from their devout liberalism, they might one day look up and realize what's actually happened. So as for Britain, that's the country that put us in concentration camps. We're not easily going to believe that they're the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry, I let slip one of the sort of key points there. I wrote down here a couple of like 7 points that I think Americans in general don't know, and one of them is that concentration camps were invented largely in South Africa by the British for us. The Germans were not the inventors thereof.
And that was 1901?
1901.
And that was for the Dutch?
I'm going to have to explain at some point in these few minutes we have that we talk about, you know, just like the Germans and the Dutch and the Belgians and the Danes and all those people would use the word Amerikaner to describe Americans. So you would be Amerikaners. In the same way, Afrikaners are the guys who settled in South Africa and eventually swore loyalty to Africa rather than their countries of origin. Suggesting that Afrikaners should go back to Europe is like, you know, even in the time of Davy Crockett suggesting he go back to England, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You get the feeling.
Yeah, yeah. Because the Dutch originally went to South Africa when?
1652 they arrived there.
See, I don't know if most people realize that.
Yeah, and what they settled was basically a wasteland, wasn't it?
Well, there was no development. There was no established civilization as such. I think the major point here is that I swear to you that every regular American and Canadian I met was totally, utterly, and wholly convinced that there were black people on the beach at Cape Town when the Dutch arrived. It's simply a flat-out lie. In fact, the nearest black people were 700 miles away. I reckon, just, you know, with my bit of knowledge of the map, I figure that's about as far as Tucson, Arizona, from where you guys are.
And why was that? Why wasn't there an indigenous population at that time in that area?
There was an indigenous population. They weren't black. People seem to think that all of Africa is black, and it's not. Hmm. Far northern Africa is not black. Okay, the Tuaregs are, let me put it this way. The people along the south coast of the Mediterranean, they're not black people.
Mm-hmm.
They're more close to the Arabs. In fact, the Somalis that your folks ran into, they may have black skins, but you try and tell them that they are black Africans, they're going to get really annoyed at you. Hmm. Okay. And in the same way, the original inhabitants of the southern tip of Africa, most of it, in fact, was the so-called San people, S-A-N. Those were formerly known as the Bushmen, and they were pygmy people, small people, very small. And along with them, their related cousins, who were formerly called Hottentot, these days the correct name for them is Khoi, and the two groups together are known as the Khoi Sun, with a hyphen in between. And so the people who were at the southern tip of Africa were the Khoi Sun. It wasn't the black Bantu people of Africa. They were the invaders.
No kidding.
So you ask the people who can trace their DNA to the Cape, and they will tell you that the black people are the invaders. And let me put it to you this way. It's not as though I have to bring you statistical data or stuff from archives to prove this. If you go east along the coast from Cape Town, and you go up towards the subtropical coast, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, you'll find that the rivers have Khoi Sun names. They don't have names generated in the language of Mandela or any of those black people. The names of the rivers are Khoi Sun names.
I'll be darned. I didn't know that.
So the people who were there when the Dutch arrived were the Khoi people. And they're a completely different human race. Completely different.
So when the Dutch arrived, I mean, did they basically get along?
Well, let me see if I can find this little bit here. Where is this bit? I just have to... Yeah, here we go. This is the instruction to the original Dutch commander from the actual archives. A good understanding with the natives will be necessary in order to make them, in course of time, accustomed to intercourse with you and so attract them. In this, great prudence is necessary. And you shall have to take especial care not to injure their cattle, which they are herding or bringing on, as this would repel them from us. Does that sound like slavery or anything like that to you, or fighting?
Yeah, it didn't really sound like a big takeover.
Yeah. Okay.
It was a pretty light light takeover plan. We have to take quick break before we delve into this, and we'll be right back. Just a really swift break. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Our guest is Dr. Harry Bouyans. You guys are going to like this show. We've got lots of information for you. Be right back.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
There you go. You know, a lot of people don't realize, but commerce between Americas and the Dutch go way, way back. And a little known fact is our Declaration of Independence was actually, the paper was actually milled by the Dutch and printed on Dutch paper. So there you go.
Well, there you have it.
Another...
That I did not know.
Yes, that's a little Dutch fact there.
I could possibly tell you another useful bit. You do know that some of the Pilgrim Fathers actually departed not from England, but from Holland.
There you go.
So that was an expatriate community that felt unsafe in England and moved to Holland, where they stayed as a community and then made their deal, so that a whole horde of them actually came from Holland. They sailed from Holland and then got laid up in the British harbors, where they lost one of the ships, and then they proceeded on with the Mayflower. So... yeah, the link goes much further. But the thing, though, is that New York was started by the Dutch, known as New Amsterdam. Cape Town was started by the Dutch about 50 years later. Both places were ultimately stolen by the British. The Brits sailed into New Amsterdam in 1664. And what do you know? Living in town at the time was my wife's ancestors. She's not an American. She's a typical South African girl. But her first, one of her earliest ancestors is actually the first American immigrant to South Africa in 1666.
I'll be darned.
Wow. And they lived in what would now be the shadow of the Goldman Sachs building.
No kidding.
Wow.
There are such beautiful, detailed maps available of the era that I've actually pinned down the location of their house. I could walk you there right now.
Oh,
it's on Stone Street in New York. The house is gone. I think it now is 7-Eleven.
Of course.
It's still, I think, the last cobblestone road in New York. It's still Stone Street. And that's where they lived. And when the Brits took the place in 1664, the family went back to Holland. They disappear. And the next moment, the two sisters, the two daughters, appear at the Cape of Good Hope as orphans.
Wow.
Yeah, and pretty much.
My family American line.
Yeah, pretty much. Back in those days, pretty much everybody got whooped up on by the British. They were the power to be reckoned with.
Sure.
And I don't know a lot about the history of the Cape, though. That was continue on with your story.
Yeah. Well, eventually in the 1680s, the Dutch, having beaten the Brits at that point, decided to sell New York in exchange for one of the islands somewhere. I can't remember which. So they didn't think New York was worth much.
No. Lousy location.
Here, take
so
it.
Much for their judgment, right? An interesting little point there is that Peter Minuit, who had preceded Peter Stuyvesant as the mayor there, like my wife's other ancestor, also basically French Protestant who went to fight in the religious wars in Germany. I think all of them came from the German town called Wesel. So they'd fought there.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of these odd little links. And here's the thing. If I decode the word Amabulu view for a second, I'll point out something else that's interesting. The Ama in front of the word, Amabulu, the title of this book, Ama is the suffix that's used in many of the black languages in South Africa to mean people or people of or the something people. So, for example, the Amabenzi these days are those people who are rich enough to own Mercedes-Benzes. They call them Amabenzi.
No kidding.
Oh, wow.
So you get the idea.
Yeah.
You put Ama in front and then the descriptive word. So way back in the late 1700s, when the black people first ran into the white guys, all the white guys they found were farmers. Now, the word for farmer in Dutch is boer, B-O-E-R, boer. But that soft R at the end, they could not pronounce, and you would struggle with it as well. So they, instead of saying boer, they said boulou. They put a lu at the end, because that's more in tune with their language. Very, very, I don't know what's the word, soundful language. It's actually, you know, full of clear, ringing sounds, the Khoisa language in particular. And so instead of talking about boer for a farmer, they said bulu. Sorry.
Bless
so
you.
If you're going to talk about the farmer people, you're going to call them the Amabulu. So I am a member of a nation that they would refer to as the Amabulu.
Okay.
More generally known in international terms as the Afrikaner. They proceeded because all the white people they knew were kind of farmers at that point, frontier farmers. So anyone white just became Amabulu. Now, here's the cute bit. I have a piece of text from the archives in New York where a British officer in the late 1680s is losing his cool and reporting on what he refers to as these darned boos. in upstate New York. So your own ancestors were also called Boer. So you are also Amabulu.
Another connection, yeah.
So you don't know it, but you're Amabulu. Amabulu. Okay? So that's where this comes from. You might ask me, why is the subtitle of this thing The Birth and Death of the Second America? Well, in about 1795, the Brits invaded the Cape and stole it, basically, just like they'd done with New York. But no one was powerful enough to drive them out of there, so no luck in getting rid of them. So about 2 years later, the commander of the Navy at the Cape, who happened to be the boss of the later famous Nelson, Admiral Pringle. Admiral Pringle went on record, and I don't have his exact words in front of me right now, but it's something to the effect that they should not really, help this place to expand, because as it got bigger and richer, it would no doubt in time steal, quote, steal India from us. They had had such a horrific experience with losing America that they weren't going to repeat this. This is why they made hostilities broke out with France in 1795, they made a beeline for the Cape and made sure this time they took it. And the reason for that is simple. In your War of Independence, the Brits and the French both raced for Cape Town because whoever controlled it controlled the oceans. And the French, the Brits sailed first, and they got to one of the islands along the way. And when the French arrived, the Brits were very occupied in the brothels in town. So the French shot the hell out of the British Navy and proceeded to Cape Town and landed their soldiers there in agreement with the Dutch. That freed up the French Navy to do what they wanted on the high seas, and that is why they could support the Americans against the Brits in your War of Independence. So if it weren't for that race for the Cape, you may not have had a United States.
No, we definitely needed the help of the French.
Okay, so that's yet another connection. But some of the other so the point is that he said this place might, Pringle said that the Cape might very well in time turn into a second America and steal India from us. Therefore, they, the Brits, should be careful not to let this place be too successful. Thank you very much.
That's
so
interesting.
Now you know what would have happened to the United States if you had stayed a British colony. You can take a look at South Africa today. That's probably what would have happened to you. So I think you should go on your knees and thank Washington and those guys one more time, because what I have to live and what I have to see happen to my family is what had been happening to you if you had not got rid of the Brits.
God, and at the end of the day, you wouldn't wish that on your worst enemy.
So the other thing let me put it this way. In 1979, a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed Harry arrived in New York. I'd been given a one-year postdoctorate exercise at IBM. So I was going to spend a year at IBM. And I had to go look for a place to stay. So everybody at IBM was awfully nice, helped left, right, and center, gave me a list of places I could phone where they knew people were advertising homes and rooms and whatever. So I phoned up a first place, and that was taken, phoned up a second place, similar story, got to the third one, and a very nice lady answered. And I remember this is around, it's not too far from Hillary Clinton's home, so Mount Kisco. Chappaqua is the next town down. So I'm phoning this lady, and it all goes very well, and then finally her voice turns conspiratorial. And she says, Harry, can I ask you a question? I said, sure, ma'am. And she says, are you black? And I told her, no, ma'am, I'm white as the driven snow. Is that a problem? You know. And that's when I realized that things are not simple in the U.S. You guys still there?
Yeah, sorry, we have an emergency thing coming in, just making a bunch of noise, so we muted ourselves so we wouldn't be making sound. Sorry, I'm sure you felt like you were hello.
Okay. So I realized that the history of the U.S. is no doubt going to be devil South Africa is something terrible. And the reason why I say that is that I realize that so much of the discourse in the United States is based on the history of slavery in the U.S. And that much of the behavior is still today dictated by that. And folks don't seem to realize in the United States that no South African indigenous black people were ever enslaved by any white people from anywhere on earth.
And see, that I think is the big misunderstanding, is that the whites went down, took over all this black area, and now they're having it taken away from them, which is totally false. But
yeah, so people in Europe jump all over us on that subject. They're looking for us behind the door where they themselves are standing.
Right. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to stay on that vein a little bit, because that is, I think, the crux of why
there's no support, there's no understanding.
Support. Exactly.
Well, and then there's the media lying. We should definitely highlight that. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Harry Buyans. His book, Amabulu, you can find all of that on our site at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes.
And we're back with our guest, Dr. Harry Buyans. All right, so, Bill, you had something. What was it?
Yeah, I raised the point that folks need to understand that if liberal folks the world over are wallowing in a pool of self-pity and regret and desperation, worried about the fact that their ancestors practiced slavery and that they enslaved black people from Africa, I just need to tell them that, excuse me, guys, but we white South Africans never enslaved the black people in South Africa. Okay? Just thought you should know. Please?
Little FYI.
You know, so we don't understand that thing. So when, as a 25-year-old, I ended up in New York and I started getting some of these strange comments and things, I realized, oh, good heavens, these people are confused about who we are and what we are. We have no background on this stuff. We don't know this. We don't, as South Africans, we're just going ahead as ordinary Christian folks. We're conservative. You know, like I said, you know, talk to me about Bibles and guns. But this stuff about enslaving the locals, where on earth does this come from? And so that is what precipitated me into starting to research the origin of some of this stuff. And I don't think we have time today to go into that, but I can tell you this. It arrived on the back of a guy called Johannes van der Kemp, who was a Dutchman in the employ of a British missionary society. He arrived at the Cape in 1800, and that big, massive lie started with him. He is the source of it, and the Brits never let go. It is difficult to find an article on the internet today that does not accuse my people of enslaving black Africans. And it just simply did not happen.
Well, that's good. And
it's a classic case of if you tell a lie enough times,
exactly,
it becomes the truth.
Exactly.
Just make it big enough. And as I told Aaron last night, always, always remember, Lenin was a newspaper man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And oddly enough, in the first ever issue of his newspaper, Iskra, what did he go on about? The Afrikaners in South Africa. But at that time, he was on our side because he was against the Brits. Anyway, so and here, well, is the ironic part of it. You know who's got the slave ancestors? I do. The white folks have the slave ancestors. The black folks don't know this subject at all. The only black South Africans who were ever enslaved were in fact enslaved by Nelson Mandela's causas. They were called the Amafengu, the beggar people, the ones who had fled from the Zulu. They were Zulu-speaking Zulus who had to flee. And for all their misery, they got made slaves by the Amakosa, Mandela's people. Okay? Mm-hmm. So it's not even a case of the pot calling the kettle black. I don't even know what proverb applies to this complete inversion of the truth. As I sit here, I am the descendant of an Indian slave in the employ of the Dutch East India Company, who arrived at the Cape in 1657. In fact, she arrived before my first white ancestor at the Cape. Her name was Great Catherine, and she became a washerwoman at the Cape settlement, in the household of the Cape commander. My wife, who was a typical South African girl, her earliest ancestor is also a slave who was on the same ship, also from Batavia in Indonesia, also Indian, and she became a wet nurse for the commander's family. The end result is both she and I had an Indian-descended slave from Indonesia in the commander's household, okay? And I have to sit and listen to these people go on about slavery? There is something just profoundly sick here.
Yeah, I know it's a fact, but it's a forgotten fact that the people of Africa, more African, black Africans were enslaved by blacks than were ever enslaved, even from any other country. In fact, most of the slave traders of the day were black. They were
black and Arabs, yeah.
Yeah, and they rounded them up and sold them off. I mean, they were the slave traders.
So. Yeah, and I thank people like the Swedes who get on the high horse these days and plead like their hands could never, never have trouble on their hands. But they had a perfectly, thoroughly functioning slave center in West Africa called Karoolisburg. So don't let the Swedes get away with.
Clean hands.
Yeah, I don't know even what to know. They just irritate me.
Damn Swedes.
The fundamental problem here is that the Afrikaner as a white man in Africa has no voice in the world. He's never had a voice in the world. As early as 1834, British missionaries were taking African chiefs to London to go and plead the case of the black people. No one of my people ever had a chance to plead their case anywhere in the corridors of power, anywhere on earth. We just had to be, we were the cannon fodder. We were just abused all the time, okay? Until the Brits finally put us in concentration camps and then lambasted the Germans for doing the same.
Right.
There's these oddities, actually, the white folks in South Africa did not enslave South African black people, but South African black people enslaved black people. And then, in the worst irony of all, it's actually the white people in South Africa who have the slave ancestors, and I'm a very good example of that. I got a couple of those in my tree. And yes, like everybody else on earth, we have the obligatory, as I put it to Aaron, we have the obligatory Italian deserter who deserted from Napoleon's army to join the British army and then ended up at the Cape, took discharge and became a good Afrikaner. Okay? So there's just all these things that are just seriously weird. But when you get down to these black politicians who are now dancing on stages and singing songs with the lyrics, kill the whites, kill the farmer, kill the white, and phrases like, we stole the land, the farmer stole the land, drive them off the farms. Well, white Afrikaners like myself were living and dying in the heart of the prairie states of South Africa when Western man did not even yet know about the existence of that politician's ancestors much further north. Mm-hmm. How can people allow this travesty of, you know, to go on? The truth is there to find. This is not a piece of mystical stuff, you know. It turns out that one has to work to get the truth. And it's because the truth is tough to figure out. It's probably the reason CNN is still in existence.
Yeah, they make a very profitable business out of missing out on the truth.
They're doing such a great job that today their CNN correspondent April Ryan tweeted out some article about Donald Trump running a child trafficking ring.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
This is the quality of reporting that's mm-hmm. coming out of CNN.
Well, I think you hit it on the head when you said that the Africana, they have no political voice, and today the loudest voice is the what are they called, the Mandela group, the A.
Something. ANC, African National Congress.
There you go. They have the voice, and
that fits in nicely with the Black Lives Matter and all the rest. Rest of the victimology that's going on. And
the problem ultimately is, if you think you are free of this, let me point out something to you. President Obama appointed Richard Stengel as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs. Richard Stengel is none other than the ghostwriter of Nelson Mandela's autobiography. Okay? And the State Department said, here's his job definition, leading America's public diplomacy outreach, which includes communications with international audiences, cultural programming, academic grants, educational exchanges, international visitor programs, and U.S. government efforts to confront ideological support for terrorism. But he writes the book For the Man, Mandela, in which Mandela says, if sabotage did not produce the results we wanted, we were prepared to move on to the next stage, guerrilla warfare and terrorism. And then he explains how we went to Ethiopia for bomb training. So this is the man that Obama appoints to confront ideological support for terrorism?
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Somebody going to explain this to me?
Yeah. No.
But you know what? We're going to have you back next week.
Yep.
And next week
we get into the farmers.
Yeah, we want to get into what's happening down there, because it is an atrocity that has to be told. And I think we've kind of laid the groundwork today.
Yeah, and that was my point.
And thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much. Our guest has been Dr. Harry Booyens.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. We will see you next week, and I hope people will hit the website. It's wethepeopleradio.us. We have all the information on there, and we'll keep you up to date with what's happening next week.